Welcome to the Pop Zara Podcast. Like, love, or follow us today on Facebook, Twitter, and more.
Wait, Jocko. Look up in the sky.
It's a bird.
It's a plane.
No, it's a turtle.
A turtle?
Yeah, super turtle.
Everybody wants to get into the act, but I'll stop them. Because Title Wax Auto Polish with Brillium gives your car a super brilliant hard shell finish that protects it like an invisible garage. A full year's supply, only $2.
Turtle Wax gives a hard shell finish. Turtle Wax!
Turtle Wax. And no, we are not getting any royalties or advertising revenue for a 70-year-old commercial. Welcome to the Pop Zara Podcast. This is your host, Nathan Evans, here talking turtles, here talking tortoises, here talking conservation. And that could only mean we are interviewing Professor Peter Laufer, author of the new book, Dreaming in Turtle, A Journey Through the Passion, Profit, and Peril of Our Most Coveted Prehistoric Creatures. That's a mouthful. Peter, welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be here with you, Nathan.
Oh, thank you. And like, I'm sure you remember that jingle. It was really hard because the Turtle Wax Company has been trying really hard to update their jingle, and I don't think they're ever going to beat the original.
No, that original is just spectacular. And for your listeners with a vivid imagination, the black and white cartoon footage that went with it, turning the turtle into a superhero, can't be beat.
Well, they've tried in the 1980s, and we can get into that. But I just love the Jimmy Durante voice on the actual turtle. You don't see that today. I don't think kids today know who Jimmy Durante is, but I also don't think they know what turtle wax is sometimes. But the hipsters will fix it for us. So getting into the book, Professor Peter Laufer, if I could just give you a little blurb real quick, is the James Wallace Chair in Journalism at the University of Oregon School of Journalism Communication. Big history as a journalist and activist and conservationist, talking specifically about education, conservation, hunger, and animal rights. The book Dreaming in Turtle concerns all three of those things. So my question to you first is, why write about turtles and why write about turtles now?
The reason to write about turtles is the same reason that humanity has been immersed in turtles across cultures and across time. Turtles have been a fixation for us humans as representatives of wisdom, of fertility, of longevity. We've used turtles for ornaments, to eat, for alleged medicine, and turtles connect us to the dinosaur age. So to your point, why now? When we're facing so many environmental problems, when we're facing so much extinction, turtles can be not just the canary in the coal mine, but the canary for the whole earth. If they survived since the dinosaurs and they are in jeopardy now, and certainly many species are, then we better pay attention.
So going back to the dinosaurs real quick, and this is the point I really want to get onto, is that I've heard the argument that the turtles, in some cases, almost predate some of our most favorite dinosaurs. But if we're going to talk about animals that come from that prehistoric age, cockroaches come from the dinosaur age, alligators, many other creatures. The question is, what separates turtles as in our public consciousness as something to preserve? For example, in the book, you travel to kitchens, you travel to seedy undergrounds, you travel to every place under the sun to try to figure out exactly what can be done to conserve turtles. But I don't think I've ever read of a similar expedition to save the cockroaches. So what makes turtles so different?
Well, cockroaches, for the most part, at least for most of us, don't represent fertility, wisdom, and longevity. They represent something to step on and squish. Not that that's necessarily a good idea. But turtles, there's a mystique with turtles that is understandable. The very uniqueness of their apparatus that they can bring themselves into their home, that they carry their home with them, that they live so long, that they move so slowly yet fuel a fable like Aesop's about beating the rabbit. These characteristics, which can fill a book, and they did indeed, are not shared by something like the cockroach. That's not to say that the cockroach wouldn't be worthy of study and that there are undoubtedly all kinds of fascinating realities to cockroaches, and they're part of our mythology and our history because of the infestations that we live with. But it isn't the same as this unique animal that is unlike any other and hence has taken on icon status throughout history.
I will say that there have been many, many efforts to try to humanize cockroaches and even to make children's television shows out of them. All failures. Never works. But turtles, they don't seem to have to work hard. And I think you know where I'm getting to, specifically in the 1980s. For a lot of our listeners who are out there, their first impression with turtles, and you do talk about this, was, of course, with the famous Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, both the comic, the cartoon, and it's a franchise that has never ended. In the book, you talk about how this love for this cartoon, and specifically turtles, has led to some unintended consequences, correct?
Yes, unintended consequences always plague us, it seems. And in this case, children were saying, "Daddy, Daddy, Mommy, Mommy, I want a turtle." And the most common turtle for pet use is the red-eared slider. And so it, speaking of infestations, infested households all over America and elsewhere. And when the thrill dissipated and nobody wanted to clean up after the turtle or much wanted to watch the turtle, it was not uncommon for the parents to figure that they could just let it go in the wild and that this would be a good thing. The intentions were undoubtedly good. However, the red-eared slider can outperform a lot of other turtles, and the result has been that red-eared sliders are on every continent except Antarctica as a plague on other turtles. So we have to be careful when we mess around.
You know, when we talk about the advantages of a turtle in its physiology and its lifespan, a lot of the same traits that attract us to it, specifically, we can get into this in a second, when we talk about using, let's just say, parts of turtle for everything from soups to aphrodisiacs, will make it a very strange pet. And I want to get into this a little bit because one of my favorite parts of the book is when you talk about Fred the Turtle. Now, for those who don't know, Peter temporarily adopted a very cute, is it a box turtle?
Yes, it's a box turtle. And yes, cute he is. At least he became cute looking to me.
And we get periodic updates of Fred's well-being, and it's very fun. But at the end of the story, no spoilers, you remain as skeptical at the end as you did at the beginning about turtles having unique individual personalities. But that theme is a constant throughout for both the people who love turtles and the people who would sell turtles, the people who would eat turtles, the people who would use the turtle for whatever purpose. My question is, why the attraction to the turtle for all those things, whether it's pet, whether it's food, whether it's, again, aphrodisiac? Why is there always a begrudging respect for the turtle as unique among reptiles?
I think that it is because of the animal itself and then the resulting cultural realities that are lasting. So the animal itself holds people's attention and has always. And when it's ground up, its shell or its eggs are used or other parts of it are used for medicinal purposes that are believed in, that's a very hard thing to have go away. And so it remains. When the flesh is represented as tasting like nothing else and being exquisitely delicious, that doesn't go away because the mythologies develop around it. And when the eggs or other parts of the animal are identified as restorative for virility, and there's testimonial to that, to that effect across cultures and across time, it doesn't go away. So part of it is the animal itself, and part of it is the fact that this history goes back to the beginning of history And we can't shed that.
When we talk about the history of the turtle, Peter, one thing that really struck out to me again and again and again is the physiology of the turtle. And I know people who study this, you know, they study the field of, I think it's neoteny, where you have animals that look cute. When you have animals that look, you know, let's be honest, some animals are more cute than others. And not just comparing the turtle to a cockroach, but comparing the turtle to a puppy or a kitten or even a rattlesnake. One of those things is going to be higher on the cuteness scale. And when we talk about turtles being pets, one thing that struck me is the fact that turtles seem to outlast their owners in some cases. And the question is, when a parent is going to say, I'm going to give my child a turtle, I want my child to have this turtle, that's not the same as a puppy or a dog where, you know, heaven forbid, we all love our pets, but they have a very shortened lifespan of which there's a natural flow. But a turtle may be something more akin to like stock in a company where you have to give it to your grandchildren. Do you think that's a problem? Is it our attention span for wanting to adopt an animal may outstrip our ability to care for an animal throughout generations?
Well, certainly that's a factor to consider when giving such a usually long-lived animal as a pet. But I hear the counterpoint to that. Also, and just the other day, met a woman who was buying a Russian tortoise specifically. I think it was a Russian tortoise specifically for her 10-year-old because she wanted the child to have a pet that would live with him throughout his life. So, yeah, she, one could say, is burdening that 10-year-old with responsibilities that I must confess I was happy to shed when I shipped Fred back to the reserve in Arizona, where he lives full time, because Fred is a messy eater and he's messy on the other side of eating too.
Yeah, you very no spoilers again, but very, very vivid descriptions of Fred. Let's just say enjoying his worms, and the result of said enjoyment. But the big theme of Dreaming in Turtle, I think you would agree, is the tagline, everyone has a turtle story. And that's what really drew me, because I thought to myself, that's true, I have a turtle story. And everyone I know has a turtle story, whether they know it or not. And for those people listening that may not think you have a turtle story that doesn't involve nunchucks and katana blades and teenagers, the question is, Peter, that when we talk about turtles in relation to culture, why do you think that there is a pull to sort of anoint the turtle as the imprintor of conservation? And if I can give you an example of this that from your book, you talk about the horrible story of the Canadian teenager, was it J.D. Crew, back in the 1990s in Vancouver, how she and her classmates were in Vancouver Chinatown and they witnessed a live turtle being chopped up into steaks and how terrifying that is. And that reminded me of a story just a few months ago about the sea turtle. I'm sure you know this story, the sea turtle with the straw in its nose that they pulled out of the ocean. And the reaction to that story was so demonstrably huge that states are now banning plastic straws because of that story. Why do you think the pull for that is so strong? And why are turtles so associated with conservation?
Well, we go back to what you said about baby animals, and most all animals, when they are babies, have a cuteness to them, even though, sure, some are cuter to our eyes than others. But that connection, that feeling of affinity for the baby turtle, that intrigue with the older turtle, the adult turtle, and looking at the reality of the likely longevity once the turtle achieves maturity, these things appeal to the nature in most of us to want to do the right thing and to take care of where we live and whom we live with. And so for the turtle, which can seem to be struggling just because it looks so strange to our eyes often, it's not something that we can anthropomorphize. And even its motions as it lumbers around, to want to put a avuncular arm around the turtle and say, let me take care of you, I think that that's a lot of what stimulates something like the response to the straw incident that you talk about.
Mm-hmm. And not just the straw incident. I remember even a few years ago, there was a turtle that was pulled out of the ocean, one of those plastic circular things, almost arresting it, and it had grown out of there. It was deformed, and it was a horrible sight to see. And I will admit, when I was doing research before I talked with you, I had to be very careful about what links I clicked on online, because there is an abundance of footage of what we talked about, of turtles being massacred today. And as much as I know that in the West, where there's been an attempt to sort of curb, especially in Chinatowns and in Asian communities, and to protect these turtles from, you know, live vivisections, it still continues, and it continues quite a bit. And I know, and that's one thing I wanted to get into real quick. Part of the book, you set out and you go to these places, you go to the marketplaces, you go there. What is that like as someone who, like yourself, is not just a vegetarian, Peter, but as someone who's a conservationist, to have to view this and be with almost a hands-off mentality? Was it difficult?
Well, I'm a news reporter by trade and profession and experience and training, and we can, most of us, usually compartmentalize and look at it as a phenomenon that's fascinating and important to report. That said, it's pretty difficult to see a living creature in abysmal conditions that's facing imminent death that might not be painless to amuse somebody's cooking pot. And although I try not to be judgmental about what somebody else chooses to do in terms of their diet, it's not necessary for humans, unless circumstances are dire, to eat turtle to survive, and certainly not to eat turtle that's being marketed in abysmal conditions.
You know, who's someone who's familiar with Asian neighborhoods and Asian markets, you know, you see, for those who don't know, you see a very different variety of foods, both on the shelves and not. And seafood flavored foods, specifically shrimp and fish, and yes, tortoise, a lot of it has become artificial flavoring, which is fantastic. But my question, when you talk about this, you do relate in the book, and I just wanted to ask you this. You did question whether or not, as a reporter, you should try it to see what you thought. Did that ever manifest, or did you not need to?
No, I successfully avoided eating any turtle. And I would probably, maybe, I hedge my language, have eaten it if I were in a position to be a guest in someone's home and would overtly insult them were I not to eat it. But even if, as I say this to you now, I'll bet I would figure out a good excuse.
I think, do you think just yourself being a vegetarian, I don't know, are you vegetarian or vegan? I apologize.
Yeah, I don't eat anything except fish, and I'm pretty practiced in avoiding it because I have been without it for so long.
Do you think having that dietary restriction helps give you leeway if someone were to say, enjoy my turtle soup as opposed to chicken soup?
Yeah, sure. We can all get away with a lot in that regard, as long as we smile and we're courteous and are not insulting to what somebody else chooses to do. And I managed to get away with it in the book.
Clearly the purpose of the book is evident in the last chapter, called Action. So for those people listening who would like to get involved in the effort to not only conserve turtles, but to, I'm just going to go on a limb and suggest that one of the prescriptions that you suggest is not necessarily to change the way, change practices in Asian cultures, but to possibly find alternatives. And I think we get this from your own experience with tortoiseshell, was it tortoiseshell glasses? And you have this variety of paraphernalia made from the shells of turtles. Artificial versions are pretty good too, and they look really nice. What prescriptions would you have for people who are listening who may be exposed to this or may be exposed to this at some point, if they want to be more, I don't want to use the word activist, but if they want to be more efficient and successful in trying to help turtles in the future, what would you say to those conservationists?
Yeah, I think that the most important thing that we can do is not worry overtly about whether grandpa's eyeglasses are made of tortoise shell, but rather think in terms of habitat protection, habitat restoration, habitat that isn't fragmented, and the enforcement of existing laws protecting wildlife, and particularly turtles and tortoises, the enforcement of laws prohibiting the export and import of non-native species internationally without permits and a productive reason for that trafficking. Those are the kinds of actions and changes in behavior that can result not just in helping the turtle and tortoise and terrapin population, but all of wildlife that is threatened during this current period of crisis that we're suffering.
Final question, and this relates to conservation and how people can get involved, but you're probably familiar with the documentary The Cove, which came out a decade ago, and the film was lauded, won an Academy Award, but there was backlash, specifically from the Japanese viewers, who felt that the portrayal of their whaling and dolphin industry was misrepresented. My question to you is, when we talk about conserving turtles, and I'll just be honest, Peter, a lot of the issues relate to China and Asian cultures and traditional Asian cultures that have been using these animals for a variety of reasons for centuries. What would you say, as China becomes a more important and pivotal economy on the world's market, what would you say to those people where it seems that there's an inevitable culture clash? We saw this happen with, you know, in certain parts of the world with tigers, with elephants, with rhinos and their tusks. What would you say to those who would be confronting that charge of, you know, cultural relativism, that, well, we should be able to do this, you shouldn't stop us because you think they're cute? What would you recommend to those people?
Well, there are two ways to approach that question. First, there are plenty of people in Asia who are conservationists and working to change age-old habits. That habits are, or customs, are age-old does not mean that they should not be changed. There are plenty of things in our society that are age-old and that we have changed because we realize that they are wrong. The second half of that, though, is this is nothing that is Asian-specific. Without the partnership of those outside of Asia who are fueling this traffic with the turtles and tortoises that are native to their lands, the same old story of supply and demand. Is as long as we label south of the Mexican border as this hideous place that's supplying drugs to us, we're forgetting that the reason that drugs are being supplied to us up here north of the border is because people are buying them.
Yes.
So these are global issues that are not specific to a region and not specific to a cultural heritage. And we need to, as people who are inhabiting this globe, approach them holistically together and decide what it is that we consider important. And meanwhile, we can eat mock turtle soup and pass on the cocaine.
I think anybody who's been to a Chinese restaurant in America in the last 30 years would know that artificial crab tastes pretty much just like real crab. And if we could do it for crab, we can do it for turtle. But I will say it's all a moot issue, Peter, because as we all know, the world is really a flat disc. It's resting on the backs of four huge elephants and on the back of an enormous turtle, the great Atuin, says Terry Pratchett. We're all just spinning on a disc.
Exactly.
On a turtle.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about the research in the book. I really do appreciate your attention and concern.
Thank you. And we have been speaking with Professor Peter Loffer about his semi-new book, Dreaming in Turtle, A Journey Through the Passion, Profit, Peril of Our Most Coveted Prehistoric Creatures. It's out now from St. Martin's Press. Go buy it, go read it, and do something about it. Get involved. Peter, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
A pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Pop Zara podcast. For more quality original content, check out popzara.com for the latest reviews and previews in gaming, movies, tech, and more.